So let's see, from 83 to 97, you were in these well-known bands. If people do not know what these well-known bands are, we'll get to them some way. But if they don't know, you know, it's kind of a problem. You just happen to also be associated with not being a legendary musician with an iconic record label. You've also been a music supervisor on films. You've been a radio presenter. And then because you don't have enough on your hands, because you just don't have, like me, you don't have enough to do, right?
No, never.
You said, you know, I'm going to go back in the studio with a friend, some guy from Jesus and Mary Chain, some guy of a little bit of cred. And I'm going to make this record, and then I'm going to make it even more complicated. I'm going to go after everybody I want. I'm going to do it in two parts. I want to start with your dad, because behind me, obviously, is Tom Jones and the Walker Brothers and Ian Dury and, of course, Dusty Springfield. Did your dad ever turn to you and say, "Son, please don't go anywhere near what I do"?
Not my mum did, but not my dad. I mean, no, he loved what he did, and he always just, you know, the one bit of advice that I always followed was just do what you want to do. Don't ever do a job that you don't enjoy. You know, if you want to be a bin man, a dustman on the street, you know, getting people's garbage, if that's what gets you off, then be a bin man. So I, you know, I remember that from a very young age, just to always kind of do a job that I wanted to do, and really treat what I do more like a hobby. And I still sort of have that approach with music. I look at it as, you know, an incredible privilege to do it, and I treat it like a hobby because a hobby is something you love, right? So I, the fact that I make a living out of it now, not an amazing one, but a good enough one to have, you know, to have my own house finally, it means a lot, you know, and I think that I have to thank my dad for that. But yeah, what a career he had. Incredible, incredible.
You know, growing up with creative parents is either a blessing or a curse, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it hurt my mum more than it hurt my dad because he was away a lot, and I guess, you know, my marriage, my first marriage did, you know, lasted a long time, but it ended because I was always away, and that, you know, when you've got young kids, that does put an awful lot of pressure on the person who's unfortunately having to stay home looking after the kids, you know. So I get all that, but certainly what I took from him as a young man and a young guy sort of getting into music for the first time was just enjoy it. And I hadn't actually really been that excited about music until punk rock happened. Because I was 14 when the Sex Pistols came to town, you know, and that was, yeah, sure, I'd enjoyed my sisters and brothers, older sisters and brothers' music, Beach Boys, you know, Roxy Music. So I was into it to a degree, but not in that way that, you know, you grasp something and it just becomes, it takes you over. And punk came along and the light bulb went on, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this is totally me. And that was kind of the catalyst to everything, really, to me following my dreams with music and starting working in a little record shop for my first job. That record shop happened to be Beggar's Banquet record shop, where 4AD Records was upstairs. My own first little band got signed to another little label upstairs. So, you know, my world at 18, when I got that job, very quickly kind of signposted me in this direction that I'm still in,
That was their Nick Hornby moment, wasn't it?
yeah, it really was. It was like the signpost was there. I maybe didn't totally recognize it fully and appreciate its significance at the time, because when you're 18, you're really, you know, you're just doing things, you're just following a road, a fork in the road. You know, it could have been that one, it could have been that one, but I felt instinctively this was what I wanted to do, and all the people I met from then are still an influence on me today. You know what I mean? It's very strange how just that one significant, insignificant moment of going in this record shop as a punter to start with, just as a, hey, oh, you know, I want to buy this single, I want to buy that single. And then a few months later, the guy going, you're in here every day, why don't you just get behind the counter and just do some work? And that, you know, that moment actually is why I'm sitting here talking to you now, really. I did eventually kind of get like everybody in that scene, you know, get quite bored of the sort of the UK punk thing, because it burnt out very quickly once it became a high street kind of commercial thing, which it very quickly did. I then was like really totally into, you know, television, Jonathan Richman, Talking Heads, Patti Smith, all the kind of the New York that we, you know, me and my school friends, we were just totally obsessed with that stuff after the kind of UK punks became a bit tedious and a bit boring and just high street music, too fashion orientated, you know. But yeah, it was all about, it was your whole being. It wasn't just about the music. It was the clothes, yes, a little bit, but it was about, you know, the thing of like getting up on stage and doing it. You didn't have to have skills to do it. You just had a passion to do it. And it's about the politics as well, because the UK was in a horrible, like America was with, you know, with Reagan and whatnot. We were in a horrible political mess with Thatcher. And it was all about, you know, anti-racism. It was all about, there was a whole Rock Against Racism movement. So there were lots of things that were happening at sort of street level that were really important to me. And being a punk wasn't about just those three chords and going to the pub at night and getting pissed and watching a band. It was just about all the stuff that kind of took over your life. And it sort of seems a bit trite now, but I guess movements do come out of, you know, hardship and political uncertainty, and hopefully, you know, hopefully there'll be something, maybe there is something and I just don't even know about it, something coming soon that, you know, is music from the street, that's exciting, because I just feel everything's been quite middle class and, you know, a bit sort of bland over the last period.
Moving forward a little bit, one of the things I read that you said was that you realized at a certain point you were so busy running a record label that you really didn't have time to grieve the death of the Cocteau Twins.
Yeah, I mean, it's mixed in with lots of personal things that kind of went wrong all around the same time. You know, the band breaking up was pretty awful. And then we had a recording studio where the band had made all its music. It was actually Pete Townsend's from The Who's building, and we rented it off him for 10 years. It was an amazing, amazing place to make music. And we were there for 10 years. And then after the band broke up, we stayed in this studio for quite a few years. And we set the label up from this studio with the premise that this studio could be, you know, the place where we make all these records for the label for free. Of course, it didn't really work out like that, because things never work out how you plan, right? The studio went bust for a number of reasons. And that was a bit of a kick in the teeth. Then I kind of, my marriage started going wrong. I lost my house. Just one thing that was going quite well and was at least interesting and tricky was the label. It was like, how do I do this? I was constantly trying to make it better and understand the music business, which I really didn't at all. Even though I was in it, I didn't understand at all the mechanics of distribution and promotion and advertising.
I don't have a clue.
So that's why I think I just sort of forgot about my own music and forgot about dealing with things very well. I just got obsessed with trying to keep this thing afloat, keep the rent coming in, keep paying the staff. And as a consequence, didn't grieve the Cocteaus at all. And it was only much, much later, almost 20 years actually, that I thought, hold on a minute, why aren't I making music? It's weird. And I sort of eventually put two and two together, and that's what I came up with.
And nice. So this music, I heard it and I got it right away. And I said, okay, you know, I wonder what went behind this. And then I read that the parameters are fun. You might never make a record ever. And even if you made a record, it probably wouldn't really be a record, and it wouldn't be a band. It would be a, you know, a thing. And so now putting it through that lens, I went back and listened and I said, not only do I get it, but you know, the fact that you put together the, you know, first session, seven songs. Now you're you, he's him, but still.
Oh, I know, that is extraordinary.
That's a pretty good, you're only supposed to do a track a day. Come on, Simon, you know how that works.
Well, certainly in the cocktails, we're at one a year. I mean, by the end, you know, by the end, things were so messy. We were taking, you know, three or four years to make a record. So this was a little bit kind of like making sure we don't go down that road of overthinking, overanalyzing. Partly it was to do with my life and the fact that I am a very busy guy, as you mentioned, and I am very impatient as well. And I do like jumping from one thing to another, so I don't get too, you know, bored. So I didn't want to be in the studio with Richie for an extended amount of time, to the point where I'd be like, okay, this is I just need to go to bed. You know, I didn't want to get to that point. I wanted it to be exciting. I didn't have any tunes. He didn't have any tunes when we went in. I hadn't picked up a guitar or a bass or a piano for years, and I liked that. I didn't find that scary. I found it exciting, you know, going in with nothing and then coming out at the end of the night with something, seven tunes or whatever it is, was amazing. Because we remember, this is how we worked, and it is a bit odd, but he would sit at the drum kit, I would sit at the piano or with a guitar or whatever, and he'd start playing or I'd start jamming something, and he'd go, oh yeah, yeah, do that, play a bit more of that. And I'd go, what are you talking about? I'm not doing anything, I'm tuning up. You know, he'd go, no, play something there. So we would just record these messing about, basically. And I didn't really think too much of it until we'd finished. And I said, well, I'll see you in a month or two's time. I'll take all this back home and see if there's anything there. And then when I'd get back home and put it into my computer, I'd be like, well, actually, that's pretty cool. I think I can do something with that. So I'd add a bass to it or I'd add a guitar to it. And then all of a sudden it'd be like, that's actually a tune. There's a tune in there somewhere. And I'd keep just adding little bits to the point where I was like, you know what? That is actually, that's a song there, but without a vocal. Who would I like to sing on this? And I would just close my eyes and imagine the voice on top of this particular piece of music. And that's sort of how the whole thing turned into Lost Horizons, you know, actual albums.
So before we dig into that, tell me about On the Day You Died, because there's an amazing story behind that.
Yeah, well, so I woke up in the morning to the news that David Bowie had died this day. And me and Richie, you know, we're the same age. I'm just 59, actually, this last couple of weeks ago. He's 59. And, you know, we grew up with this man's music. He's incredibly important to all of us. He's to everyone on the planet. I mean, that's obvious. But, you know, Low, Heroes, huge records for me. And subsequently, you know, all the stuff that I discovered after those records, because that was my entry point, was Low, right. Actually. Yeah. The sort of Eno Berlin period. That's how I got into Bowie, and then very quickly, you know, backtracked to, you know, the earlier records Young Americans and all that stuff later. So when he died, we were in the studio like that week, and when I woke up, I texted him. I was like, oh, mate, have you heard the news? And so he said, yeah, call me. So I called him up. I said, I don't feel it. You know, I just feel so sad, and I just want to kind of stick my head under the pillow and just go back to sleep. And he said, no. We've got to go in. You know, we have to go in. He got it. You know, he said, no, we have to go in there and use that energy in whatever way we can as a tribute to him, and, you know, just honoring it as much as we can. And I was like, okay, well, if you really think that, then I'll come up. So I got up from London, from Brighton, which is, you know, quite a long way away from the studio we were recording at in London. So I went in, and Richie is an amazing saxophone player, which he never plays the saxophone. Okay, he's played on a couple of Cocteau Twins tracks back in the day. He played on some This Mortal Coil stuff with me back in the day, but I don't think he's touched his sax, or hadn't touched his sax, in about maybe 15 years. But as you well know, David Bowie was an incredible sax player as well. And I was like playing this thing on the piano, and I just said, just pick up the sax. Come on, you know, let's really honor him properly. And he recorded this thing. He hated it, by the way. He absolutely hated his sax part, but I loved it. And I always just thought, man, we should just mix it really quickly. Take an hour just to mix it, and we'll just use it on something. We'll just put it out. And that's how that track came about. And he always regretted it, because he says his sax playing's awful on it, and it's all noisy and reedy. And I'm like, no, no, no. That's the whole point. You made me come in that day. You made me come in. I didn't want to come in, but you made me come in. And now you're saying that what you did, influenced by his death, isn't any good. You're talking rubbish, mate. We're absolutely going to use it. And he listened to me and he agrees.
So a lot of people would say that you're following the trends because whether it's the Mark Ronsons of the world or the Mobys of the world or the, and you know where I'm going here. You know exactly where I'm going here. You know, it's like, we're going to make a record. We're going to make some music. We're going to throw a bunch of cool vocalists on it. Right. That certainly was not your intent here, but how did you decide on the chicken and the egg? Meaning which comes first, you know, cause you had them write the lyrics. You chose a different omelet here.
Yes, well, I chose an omelet that I know how to make, and I know which bit of the omelet has got my ingredients in it, and which where it needs to be taken over by a proper chef, because I know what my limitations are. Because after whatever it is, 30 odd years of making music, I know what I'm all right at, and I know what I'm not so great at. Singing, I can sing, but I'm not great at it, and lyrics, I can't be bothered with it right now. So, because I work with so many amazing people in my other job as running Bell the Union, I thought it would be fun. And also, I think the Liz Fraser Cocteau Twins thing is worth mentioning here, because I still have it in my head, somewhere in the back of my head, even though I fight it daily, that I'm never going to find a singer to be the front of my band that's as good as she is, right? That's got to be in my mind somewhere. And that maybe is why I started thinking of different song, different singer. I don't want one singer to sing all these songs. I'd like lots of different ones. It's about trying to kind of create something interesting for myself and Richie. And that's why that started that way. And also because I love instrumental music. So I finished a load of instrumental songs with Richie. And then I thought, shall we just put these out as instrumentals? And then I was like, I think that's a bit boring. Let's, you know. And then the next logical step was speaking to some singers, giving them a theme to work on, which I've always done. I've always sort of, my mum had died just before the recording of the record.
Yes.
And I would say that to all the singers. I'm like, you don't need me to tell you what to write a song about. I wouldn't even dream of telling you. But sometimes people, singers do like to have a guide, do like to have something to go on. What do you want me to write about? You know.
It certainly gave them a tone.
And some really followed it. A couple just completely ignored it and did their own thing, which I also thought was perfectly fine. And as you say, it's sort of given the record a bit of a melancholic feel to it, which I love because that's my kind of music. That's what
it's kind
I love.
Of what you do.
It's what I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate that and love that. Invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two, normally, now I underline normally, I have another idea for you. It's two songs on the outside and anything you want to play in between. And then I play, you know, 40, 50 minutes of nonstop music